Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, joined today by Harriet Russell. How are you doing, Harriet?
Yeah, good, thanks, John.
Excellent. And Julia Forshaw, how are you doing?
Good, John.
Excellent. Lots of news this week. The world's gone slightly mad today for obvious reasons. I'm in a huge panic because it's our awards tonight. I've been busy writing speeches and ironing shirts and such the like, which I don't usually do, as you will bear witness to. Where do we start? Let's start with the news section. We're going to talk about retail mainly today and various things in the travel and leisure sector because we've had some interesting news there from the airlines in particular, but also gambling. Let's start with retail, which is the lead story in the news section. This is about fast fashion. Yeah. What is going on here?
It's a funny one. Basically, we were following up on a piece that the FT actually published first, but we've sort of put our own kind of analysis onto it. What they had reported on was the fact that the Environmental Audit Committee, which is a parliamentary committee, has sent letters to several fast fashion companies, which include the likes of ASOS and Boohoo, but also Amazon is included on that list. Basically demanding to know how they're going to tackle issues over sustainability in that particular part of the apparel market. It's been a big challenge, and I think a lot of this sort of ethical decision-making is having a spotlight shone on it quite suddenly.
Yeah, I mean, cheap clothes has been a bit of an issue for some time. Obviously, there were concerns around the supply chains of, in fact, all retailers after some pretty horrific accidents at manufacturing sites out in, I think it was Bangladesh was the worst one.
Yeah, that was a Primark accident.
Absolutely. So there was a lot of tightening of supply chains there, but this is something slightly different. So when you say fast fashion, this is clothes that are produced very quickly to hit sort of current market trends.
Yeah.
And often in the UK.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that the biggest difference is that we're actually talking about manufacturing issues much closer to home. This isn't just a sort of well-trodden story about abuse of labour markets in the Far East or other regions like India and Bangladesh. This is actually a story that's as close to London as Leicester. There's been a lot of criticism over the manufacturing suppliers up there that are used by people like ASOS and Boohoo, and amongst other things, you know, illegally low wages. But the audit committee is now slightly more preoccupied. Labour laws are still high on their list, but they're also preoccupied with the actual environmental damage that is done by these companies, which sell extraordinarily cheap clothing that teenagers and young people buy in the bucket load only to wear it once and throw it away afterwards.
Throwaway fashion, I think they call it.
Yeah, and people may have read in the broadsheets, you know, a lot of coverage over our relationship with China. They buy a lot of our recycling, particularly when it comes to textiles recycling, and they're starting to put their foot down. They're saying we just can't take any more. The volume is just absolutely ridiculous. And our own landfills here are overflowing, so it seems like the government is trying to get a little bit tougher on just what these companies contribute to that.
Yeah. So what could the implications of this review be? I mean, what is the risk to companies like ASOS and Boohoo? Should the parliamentary committee find something that it wants tackled?
Yeah, I mean, well, this is sort of our own, this is where sort of the FT stops and I suppose the IC steps in, because from my own sort of following of Vice Stocks, which is obviously now Julia's remit.
But, and which we'll talk about very shortly, because that's the subject of Mark Robinson taking stock this week.
Yeah. Vice is obviously a sort of subsector of travel and leisure, and you have companies like tobacco and gambling falling into that category. And obviously for many, many years now, those industries have been subject to heightened regulation and more taxes pretty much every single year in order to sort of keep them in line and make sure they're not doing as much damage. I mean, one of the biggest stories for Julia this year has obviously been the fixed odds betting terminals, which are in the news again this week.
We'll talk about that.
So I've made the sort of judgment that I think it's not out of the realm of possibility that these companies could be facing some sort of environmental tax in the future on the sales that they make, possibly within this country, possibly globally. You know, ASOS is a hugely international business, so I don't know whether the parliamentary committee might struggle to get, you know, taxes applied overseas in the same way, but I do think sustainability is going to become a much bigger theme in this sector overall, so I wouldn't be surprised to see other countries imposing similar legislation in the way that tobacco has as well.
Yeah, I mean, you might also think that if these companies are sort of labelled as environmentally damaging, that might limit the number of fund managers who are prepared to buy them, given that ethical
Absolutely.
Investment concerns are increasingly behind a lot of the decisions they make.
Yeah, and the point about taxes and why they're so effective is that in order to make up that cost, ASOS and Boohoo would inevitably have to raise prices, so the consumer is also affected. But price is pretty much the most important factor for these companies when it comes to maintaining market share, when it comes to beating the competition, keeping volumes up. So it might also deter, their core demographic. Mm. So the implications could be, pretty widespread, actually.
So not an immediate concern for profits, but something to watch on the horizon.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be a consistent theme, I think. It's not something that's going to go away.
Mm, absolutely. You talked about Vice. Two bits of news in the magazine this week. One is fixed odds betting and the maximum stakes that can be used on fixed odds betting terminals. It was the first parliamentary rebellion of the week, which has brought forward the date upon which the new rules are going to come into force.
Yes, that's right. Well, originally the idea had been that they would come into effect in April. And then in the budget in October, Philip Hammond pushed that back to October.
2019.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then there was so much pressure from Parliament after that he's now reversed his stance and brought it back up to April again, which makes sense in the sense that it's the beginning of the tax year. But it's a big step down on his part.
Did it have much of an effect on the share prices of the companies within the sector?
Today they're down. They're up a bit yesterday, especially GVC, because the timing of the payments regarding to Ladbrokes would have been more favorable for them if it had been pushed to October,
mm-hmm.
Or if it was pushed to April. But today they're all down because the three biggest players that are affected are GVC and also William Hill and Paddy Power Betfair, and they're all down between about 3% and 5% today.
Yeah, although the market's pretty fraught place today. Yeah. Anyway, the other Vice sector that you cover is tobacco, which is the subject of Taking Stock, as I mentioned. And there's been some news from the US here, which has hit some of the companies in that sector particularly hard.
That's right. The Food and Drug Administration in the US, which is the regulator there, they are apparently getting ready to ban the sale of menthol cigarettes, which is particularly bad news for British American Tobacco and to some extent Imperial brands, but less so.
Yeah, why menthol in particular? Is there
apparently they find that menthol cigarettes are more difficult for smokers to quit than the traditional kind.
Okay.
Apparently.
I mean, you mentioned that it's hit both companies, but BAT slightly harder.
Yeah, BAT significantly harder.
Is this anything to do with their recent acquisition out there?
Yeah, I mean, they have a much greater exposure to the US than Imperial Brands does, which was made increasingly more so with the acquisition of Reynolds. And Reynolds owns this brand called Newport, which is one of the biggest selling menthol cigarette brands in the US. So this looks like particularly bad news for them.
Mm. So is it all over for tobacco stocks? I mean, these have been stalwarts, defensives. People, don't really stop smoking much. We have seen declining smoking rates in Western economies, but, there are still a lot of smokers out there. But is this the kind of end game now?
I mean, it depends what sort of time frame you're looking at, I think, because both stocks feature on our income majors list. Imperial Brands has for a while, and the acquisition of Reynolds pushed BATs onto it as well.
Although it's now lost 42% of its value over the past year.
But we have Imperial Brands on a buy, and I think that that's it, at least over the medium term, is a prudent move because they've committed to these 10% increases in the dividend every year over the medium term. So far, that seems to be quite well covered by cash flows. I mean, these businesses are highly cash generative, at least now anyway. Every year the volume of traditional cigarettes sold falls and falls and falls, but there's still the 90-something percent of revenue for both of them too. Mm. But then also both have done quite well in innovation and looking at these next generation products and how they can kind of, this might sound harsh, but keep their customers addicted in a different sense, something that's maybe more
in a more
friendly,
healthy sense.
Yeah, more regulator friendly sense. But so over the medium term, especially Imperial Brands, I think it's still worth buying those shares. Over the long term, we'll see if they can actually manage that shift from people smoking traditional cigarettes to maybe using a vapor product instead.
Yeah.
If that can kind of continue to, I don't know, hold up cash flows. But in the meantime, it has.
Yeah, it's nevertheless a bit of a difficult time for that industry, and certainly one that's testing investors somewhat at the moment. Let's flip back to the news. You've now picked up the pharmaceutical beat again, Harriet, which is what you first covered at the magazine.
Yeah, back on the healthcare horse.
And there's been some talking of dividend majors. This is news from one of the other big companies that features on that dividend majors list, income majors list. AstraZeneca.
Absolutely. Yeah, it had a third quarter. Actually, almost a week ago, given the sort of production timing of the magazine, but it was a very interesting update. Those readers who are familiar with the stock will know that for many years, back when I first covered the beat, the company was promising that in the long term it was going to fundamentally shift its business model from a very traditional backbone of respiratory drugs into innovation and ultimately cancer and oncology. And those really have been the buzzwords in pharmaceuticals for as long as I've been familiar with the industry. But finally, in the third quarter of 2018, it seems that pursuing that strategy for Astra is starting to pay off.
So there's two developments there. One is that it's managed to sell some respiratory products. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Well, it's divesting these sort of what they now deem non-core medicines. So medicines that are sort of incidental, I suppose, to their growth. So they earn a fair bit of money, but it's nothing material, and it's certainly not going to ramp up in the long term. If anything, it will just lose patent exclusivity pretty quickly and face generic competition. So we only made one of those updates into this particular news story, but they actually had three divestment announcements last week, all in sort of fairly immaterial payments. But it does show that over the longer term, this is what they're going to pursue. And then in the third quarter, the main sort of product sales, if you like, were mostly buoyed by sales of new cancer drugs, which is exactly what they've been promising for a long time.
Yeah. So has it been enough to shift us back onto the buy list?
Well, not in this particular story, but it's certainly one that I'm going to have a closer look at in the next few weeks, perhaps, because, it's obviously its big counterpart is GSK, which is pursuing a very different kind of strategy. So the two businesses, in my opinion, have never looked more different. And they're two different kinds of bets. You know, taking over from Megan on this beat, she was ultimately bullish on GSK, but it's not the same company, and therefore it would be quite plausible to have a buy case on GSK and a buy case for AstraZeneca. We would just urge readers to try and look at the stories fairly independently.
Yeah, and there are still some, I mean, despite the good news this week from AstraZeneca, there are still some risks to its ability to execute the strategy.
Yeah, absolutely. If anything, I would say AstraZeneca is the higher risk business model because it's a lot more value tied up in the development pipeline, you know, and what the development pipeline means is ultimately clinical trial risk and risk of big high profile failures. I mean, for a business like this, despite its scale, despite its size, you know, having a big cancer drug fail even in a preliminary trial, let alone a phase three, can be massively destabilizing. So there's still plenty of risk there,
but still a hold
for now.
Same page, Julia, Flybe. This is potentially the end of a sorry saga.
It's not looking very good for Flybe at the moment, but potentially it could be a turnaround if they do manage to find a buyer now that it's put itself up for sale.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating story. I mean, Flybe floated a few years back and the shares have been on a downward, losing altitude ever since. They did bounce a bit on this news. I guess hopes of a white knight have given them a bit of a boost. But yeah, Flybe, tell us, I mean, how has it got itself in this state before we talk about how it's going to get itself out of it?
Yeah, well, at the moment, it's just basically been focusing on reversing mistakes that it's made in the past. Previously, it was so focused on expanding its capacity and just did so at a far too rapid rate, and only to realize that they weren't filling the seats. And so they're in the process of still trying to scale that back now. And over the period, they made progress. I mean, capacity was down 9%. Load factor improved from 76% to 84%.
Load factor being
basically the percent of seats on the planes that are filled.
Yeah. And that, because I looked at these before the results announcement, and I think when I looked at it, load factor was around 75%, which is Which is very
low. When you compare it to like an EasyJet or a Ryanair, which are in the high 90s consistently, it's just, it pales in comparison.
Yeah. So who potentially is going to buy this? And would it be an appalling decision to buy an airline that has had so many problems over the years?
Well, the first one that popped into mind was Stobart Group, mainly because at the beginning of this year, they were in discussions with Flybe to potentially buy them. And then in March, they announced that they just couldn't reach a deal and it had all fallen through. And incidentally, that was rumored to be what spurred the board infighting at Stobart Group that progressed during the middle of this year. But yeah, they would be likely the most likely one.
Mm.
But EasyJet has since come out and said that they would potentially look at not buying the whole business, but potentially bits and pieces of it, like taking certain routes
or landing sites or whatever it might be. Because it's a lot of its business is domestic, so UK flights, you know, internal UK flights. And obviously, I guess one of the main rationale for Stobart being potentially interested is that Flybe are quite a big customer of Stobart in terms of its landing slots at Southend Airport.
Yeah, that's right. But the plan was that was going to be scaled back by 2020. So in theory, you would think that if Stobart does go and buy Flybe, then that might change. So it might, in that sense, be quite beneficial for Stobart.
Yeah, although they've done a deal with Ryanair to take a lot of capacity at Southend.
It is, yeah. Ryanair is planning to base a lot more planes there. So see how they can do that balancing act.
So what do we now think about the shares? We have actually got this one right. We've had them on a sale for quite some time.
Yeah, we have had them on a sale for quite some time. And yesterday the shares bounced a bit. And we did move them from a sell to a hold. And I was quite torn on the matter because, I mean, the business isn't in good shape. And if a buyer doesn't come through, then that will be a huge disappointment. But if one does come through, then you could see shares bounce up significantly more. So in the meantime, while they're in this negotiation process, I thought it was most prudent to just kind of move to the sidelines and stick with a hold.
I think that makes sense. I think that makes sense. There's been some other interesting news from one of your companies this week, actually. May has gone this week. It's not the May that most people would like to go this week. It's the chief executive of
Patisserie Valerie,
whose name is
Paul May.
Paul May, that's right. What is going on there?
No one really knows, and that's kind of the problem, I think. But it's not really surprising, is it? The chief financial officer was arrested and then released, and they still haven't come up with any idea of what actually happened with its accounts. It's going to be some kind of fraud. We don't really know what kind of fraud, but yeah, I think that it boils down to the problem is no one really knows what happened.
There was a big shareholder meeting, wasn't there?
There was.
Presumably that didn't go so well.
No, it was an absolute disaster, apparently, and he was just getting grilled the whole time. So the fact that he's gone is not particularly a surprise. The
shares aren't trading yet, are they?
No, they're still suspended.
Okay, well, watch this space. Let's quickly turn to the results section, because I know both of you have had a very busy week writing results. Sainsbury's, the lead result this week. I think we spoke about them very briefly last week.
Yeah, we did.
Did we get any more flavour of what's going on there from the results statement?
Not really, because of course they're tied up in this CMA investigation as to in regard to their potential merger with Asda, and so for now a lot of the numbers are kind of. I suppose the numbers aren't treading water, but the shares are, because people are waiting for a decision from the regulator either way. And the decision could be so varying. I mean, in terms of what they've found so far, it's already in stage two. They have found a significant amount of areas in which Sainsbury's and Asda overlap in a geographical sense. So it will be interesting to see whether the regulator imposes any kind of disposals on this merger in a way, because it didn't with Tesco and Booker.
But they were different businesses.
Indeed. And the main difference is that I like to refer to it as Tesco and Booker being a vertical sort of tie-up, whereas this one is much more horizontal. It's about spread as opposed to supply chain integration. So, yes, I think the regulator could find justification for imposing a different set of limitations on this deal in a way that it couldn't with Tesco Booker.
It's quite interesting, though. I mean, their shares have done quite well this year.
They have done well. There was a good response to the Asda tie-up when it was first mooted, more so I think than people expected, and I think it's because of everything else going on in this sector. We're going to hopefully prepare a much bigger report on grocers and supermarkets for our new Alpha product, but we're sort of waiting for a decision to be made with Sainsbury's Asda. But you know, it's been a huge sort of consolidation theme throughout this whole part of the market because they just can't defend themselves on their own in the way that they used to. It's going under a significant structural shift.
It's becoming a much more interesting sector than it used to be. I mean, you know, the business of selling food has changed to, obviously, over the years, the business of selling food and general merchandise. But now you've got the three big players in the UK all pursuing very different strategies.
Different, but ultimately with the same motivation, which is that they have to defend themselves against two ends of the market, which is Amazon, which not only owns the internet, but also is starting to explore its sort of the premium end of the market with its Whole Foods acquisition. And then obviously the German discounters are still winning market share month on month. So you're sort of fighting on two fronts. And this issue of the squeeze middle, which is, you know, a well-trodden phrase in supermarkets, has never been more true, but it's also never been more complicated. So it's interesting to see how Sainsbury's and Tesco and Morrison's are each going to fight that.
Have we heard much from Tesco about its new discount venture? What is it, Jacks?
Jacks, yeah.
No. I know that the FT spent some time going around its shops. Our former editor, in fact, who's now the retail correspondent there, spent some time in a Jacks. It looked pretty grim.
It's sort of designed to be in the nicest way possible.
I like a Lidl.
Well, yeah. This is Tesco's answer to Lidl.
I'm not sure about that.
And yeah, they had two trial stores a couple of months ago that opened sort of in the southeast. And it was interesting. There are a few photographs. They're easily searchable on the internet if anyone's interested to have a look. But the idea is that they are producing a much more sort of value-orientated position so that, you know, their traditional customers could have the option to trade down if they wanted to while still remaining loyal to the Tesco brand.
Mm. Talking of food, let's quickly touch on Premier Foods. That's one of yours this week. I mean, in fact, you've both written, as I was reading it, I noticed your initials quite a lot throughout the results section this week. You've obviously been very busy. Premier Foods, again, a business that has been through the wars somewhat. What's going on here? This was a bad mistake of mine, tipping this one years ago.
Did you? I didn't realise that.
Oh. I did indeed.
Yeah, well, I mean, so the current management team, since they've been in there, they've made progress. I mean, debt it's still very high, but it's halved from like the £1 billion worth of debt that they inherited when they came in. So comparatively, it's doing a bit better. But yeah, its latest development is it's decided to put its custard business, Ambrosia, up for sale.
I have to say that this story, I edited this story, it contains possibly the most sophisticated pun I've ever read by an IC writer.
Go for it.
Well, Julia, you do the honours. You wrote it.
I will be completely honest and say it was entirely unintended. But yeah, it's a custard business. And apparently when you're making custard, so Harriet tells me, separation is a big problem. And so when I was speaking to the chief financial officer on the phone, he told me that Ambrosia kind of made the most sense to sell because it was the most easy to separate. And so I put that phrase into the copy, completely unaware that this is actually quite a big problem when making custard.
I have to say,
Harriet she found it quite hilarious.
I would have missed that entirely too, because I don't make my own custard. I buy it from Ambrosia. Ready made. Interesting. This business, it's been slimming itself down for years. It sold off things like Quorn, which is another thing I eat lots of. It always seems to sell the best bits, and I often wonder what's left of it. But there you go.
Yeah,
that's a real challenge, though, isn't it? I mean, that was something we were talking about when they came out, is, you know, are these sorts of sales? You have to look at it in broader contexts, like the pub groups, for instance, have for years been forced to sell off their best assets in times gone by, which leaves you with, you know, an estate full of crappy properties. And, you know, could these businesses that are ultimately made up of either conglomerates or multiple brands be going the same way?
Yeah, Diageo sold a few brands this week.
They sold 19 in their 19 of the not very nice brands too.
Well, so. Nobody seems sure. They got what was quite a handsome price for a number of brands that nobody was really very aware of.
Yeah, I think they're bigger in the US because they seem to be maybe a bit more recognizable to me than North American, not American. But it's kind of, I think Diageo has been quite good at focusing on the trend in that maybe millennials aren't drinking as much as their previous generations did. But when they do drink, it seems to be the more high quality stuff. So it's the craft beers, it's the premium spirits. So Diageo just thought it was prudent to get rid of some of these cheaper, not very nice ones.
Fair. I would go not very nice, I think. Maybe cheap, less well known, less popular. let's talk about B&M, because that was a tip last week, and they surprised us with unscheduled results.
Well, it depends what you sort of mean by unscheduled, because it wasn't a profit warning. The main example that we have of unscheduled results is always that there's, you know, something that they have to tell the market about immediately. It wasn't a profit warning, but it also wasn't good. So I can understand why they had not been put into the financial calendar for the company.
Good in the sense that the top line is not growing as quickly as it had been previously.
Yeah, and it's mainly limited to the UK. I mean, they are an international business because they have a German sort of division known as Yarvol. And then they have just announced this acquisition of Babu in France, which was a big motivator for doing the tip last week. Its track record, particularly when it comes to things like return on capital employed, is actually very strong. And we had sort of hoped that the UK business would tick along whilst they pursued this European expansion. Unfortunately, what these results showed was that performance in the UK, at least on an underlying basis, was completely flat, which spooked a lot of people because, as we were saying with Phil actually on the podcast last week, this year, which has been horrendous for retail really all round, what has held up quite well is the discount end of the market.
This is something you're looking at actually in a feature.
Yeah,
it comes out in a couple of weeks.
We're going to look at luxury versus discount and sort of try and ignore the squeeze middle for once, I think, and try and look at this whole budget versus bling, I think, is the working title. But I think the market was largely spooked by the idea that discounters may have peaked this year and maybe trying to repeat their performance over the last 18 months is going to be a harder task. We had actually mooted that as part of B&M earlier in the year, which had kept us on hold for quite a long time with them. But I do still think I have kept it on the live tip. And I think the reason for that is because the opportunities that they have to pursue this European expansion is still very ripe. And if they can get that right, then hopefully that'll be sort of the main motivator for a lot of the future growth.
Yeah, I think October was a pretty horrible month for retail generally. There were some figures out today, which I suspect everybody missed because they'd be looking at something else going on in Parliament.
Because you're a retail professional. No, they were down 0.4% from the ONS, which actually is not the most dramatic fall we've had on a monthly basis this year. But of course, what is happening now, which will be the topic of this week's coming sector focus, so not in the mag this week, but of course, we're looking at Black Friday now. And what you have is a twofold effect. You get pull forward on Christmas. So Christmas sales don't look nearly as good as they used to. Certainly the weeks before Christmas, sort of one or two beforehand, can be really weak now. But what you also get in the months of October in particular and early November is a complete quietening from retail consumers because they're waiting in hot pursuit of those discounts that are going to hit us towards the end of next week.
I can't wait.
Can't we all?
There are some other results that they're not retail results. They're related to retail from the property sector. Mm. The big REITs, British Land and Land Securities, both had results. Both are having a bit of a tough time because of retail. And in the case of British Land, reducing their retail exposure, which seems quite sensible.
Definitely. I mean, the two sectors have been so interrelated this year, more so than in all of my years here at the IC. But it's certainly an interesting context because in the 7 days section this week, we're talking about the fact that House of Fraser yesterday, which has been bought by Sports Direct, has failed to negotiate new rents on four of its big stores.
They were owned by Intu, which is another big listed landlord. Mm. I thought that was quite interesting. I did a little bit of reading on that this morning, and Intu basically said we can do better.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting because Jonas, obviously, who's our property guru, is not here to sort of defend that sector. But what I have said for a long time is, what do these landlords actually want? Do they want companies declaring CVAs and sort of effectively declaring themselves 50% bankrupt so that they can just get out of those stores? Do they want a bunch of empty properties? Mm. What do they think they can reasonably expect from these failing department stores? It's in their interest to have properties that are filled and at least generating some sort of monthly income, but this week's decision suggests not.
Well, yeah, they suggest they can fill them with other, I think they said, large scale retailers or some kind of mixed use retail that's or mixed use, even not even necessarily retail.
Well, mixed use is a really interesting theme. We're going to look at this in a feature, hopefully in the not too distant future, because even the pub groups actually have started to lease some of their extra space, haven't they? And it's incredible to see these companies that have such exposure to leases and lease liabilities, which of course are going to cause us even more aggro come the start of next year, really start to explore options on how they can make more money from that space.
But then look at Debenhams, which is another department store retailer that's having a terrible time. Their shares have taken an absolute battering this week, and we'll come on to why. But they obviously gave over some space to Patisserie Valerie, which...
Yeah.
I mean, why has Debenhams taken such a pounding this week? Because there's been no bad news from them specifically.
There's been no bad news from them specifically, but of course, people familiar with the sort of end of the market, and particularly familiar with Mike Ashley's extensive high street portfolio, will know that Sports Direct has a 30% holding, pretty much, in Debenhams. So I think the market was possibly doing a bit of read across on what had happened at House of Fraser, thinking if the landlords are going to hold fast on these rents, then what are the chances that Debenhams, which itself has said it will need to renegotiate rents on many of its large properties to stay afloat, if House of Fraser can't do that and Mike Ashley can't do that, then what makes them think Debenhams will achieve the same thing?
Yeah, I mean, actually, we had Debenhams on a sale, didn't we, for... And that was a kind of contentious call because they'd fallen so far.
We now have it on a sell as well.
Yeah, no, but that's what I mean. Even after falling, they have continued to fall. And you might have thought that they'd reached the bottom, but
I will let readers into a sort of behind the scenes moment at the IC, which was going to a weekly tips meeting with Algie, and I sat down and I presented Debenhams as my sell idea, and I said, I know what you're going to say, Algie. It's already down 70-odd%. Why are we selling now? And he just looked at me and said, because it's going bust. And I said, well, yeah. So that is, you know, it's a very aggressive sell case on that. I don't see that company rising from the ashes unless it goes through something extremely significant like a CVA, but we all know that those have dilutive effects on shareholders, and retail shareholders get battered in that process, so it's no good.
But you're glad you're taking on the farmer beat now. Some good news finally.
I know, well, this year's been a nightmare for tipping, I have to say. So yeah, hopefully a bit more good news from Pharma.
Absolutely. Let's finish off with First Group. I know we said we weren't going to talk about it too much because Phil has done a very big piece on First Group this week, looking in detail at its accounts. But yeah, this is. I mean, it's not the worst share price I've seen, but it's kind of reflective of this company's.
Not really the best either, though.
For a transport group, not going anywhere fast.
Yeah, certainly not. Especially its Greyhound business too, because they've decided to wind up a lot of the operations in Western Canada, which was a big portion of their operations before. And yeah, a $28.5 million charge on the business wiped out group profits for the interims. So it's not looking good.
Is there anything good in this business? I mean, it's still got Greyhound in America, which people still use.
Greyhound's had such a struggling time because the just short-haul flights have become so much cheaper.
Right.
And it's just a much nicer experience than sitting on a coach for how many hours, when you can get on a plane, be on for an hour, get off the plane.
Yeah, although I hear some of the short-haul operators in the US would give Ryanair a run for their money in the customer service stakes, but...
It's more for amount of time spent on there, maybe less than the customer service sense, but... The first student school bus division is not too bad.
These big old yellow buses.
Yeah, those big old yellow buses. Yeah, they're big in North America as well. And they've had a bit of a tough time just in the sense that they're finding it quite hard to find drivers and that will accept the salaries that they pay them. They're being forced to pay them more now.
But this seems to be the story of everywhere.
Yeah, everywhere, really. But yeah, so that's not going too badly. They tend to have quite good... history with retention rates and new contract wins, so that's kind of a brighter spot, I suppose.
Yeah, travel not a pretty sector either. Actually, there was some other news this week which hasn't made it into the magazine, which is Dark Group.
Yeah, shares are down like 18% last time I looked before we came downstairs.
Yeah, this is Jet 2 Holidays. I've seen the adverts.
That's right.
Package Holidays. Are people not going on holiday anymore?
That's not really so much the problem. They expanded capacity by 24% in the number of plane seats available, which when you look at an industry, like you look at Flybe that expanded way too quickly and it ended up being their downfall. And you get companies like an EasyJet where they increase capacity, but at a much slower rate. A 24% increase over an interim period seems incredible. But I mean, at this point, they did still manage to increase load factor and the number of passengers. Which is, so far it's good, but it just kind of makes you wonder, like, that's a huge increase for a 6-month period.
Yeah, in fact, it ties neatly with my editorial, which is also on airlines. But I found a quote from Warren Buffett, who described The worst sort of, this is his quote, the worst sort of business is one that grows rapidly, requires significant capital to engender the growth, and then earns little or no money. Think airlines.
And transport in general, really.
Transport in general. So transport of people. Transporting
right.
stuff around seems okay. For now, I suppose. Okay, thank you, Julian. Thank you, Harriet. Yeah, lots of ground covered there. There is lots more in the magazine. It's in fact our investment trust special, and there are pages and pages of ideas devoted to investment trusts, which our readers love, which they will no doubt be talking about on their podcast tomorrow. We've got all the usual comments. Algie, in fact, has added a little bit of extra comment this week. His further reading series, which we're planning to roll out a little bit more extensively in the new year. Obviously, Dillo, obviously Thompson, doing their usual thing. A very busy week on the results front, as we've alluded to, and does that continue next week?
It certainly does.
Hooray! All the usual tips. We have John Rosier's diary. He's had a horrible October as well, as I think most people have. And yes, well, there you go. That is the Investors Chronicle this week. Investment Trust Special, investments for all seasons, investment trust ideas to suit all market conditions, particularly apps, given the market conditions we are experiencing at the moment. Pick up the magazine and all good news agents, £4.90, or get online and subscribe. See you again next week.